Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, friends. Welcome to Open Book, your on-the-air spiritual book club. I'm Lori Strawn, and with me, as always, is my friend Alice Shelton. Hi, Alice.
Hey, Lori, how you doing?
I'm doing just fine. Well, today's book is something a little bit different. It's called The Heart of the Enlightened, a book of story meditations by Anthony DeMello. The book is filled with sayings, stories, and little folk tales from around the world that should provoke thought on spiritual issues. Let us begin with a quotation from the author's introduction. It is a great mystery that though the human heart longs for truth, in which alone it finds liberation and delight, the first reaction of human beings to truth is one of hostility and fear. Respond to this, Alice. Why do you suppose this is so, and can you think of any concrete examples?
Oh, I was just having a reaction to truth today. It's so funny to think about this.
Really?
Yes. And, you know, the truth is capitalized here, but I don't think it necessarily has to be. But you think of an interpersonal conversation where someone you care about shares with you something that they observe about you or that they know about you, or when you yourself start to really deeply own something about yourself, it's like you judge it in a negative way, even if it isn't. You know, and I can't think of good examples of positive things about myself, but sometimes even the truth about gifts that I have, there's fear about, well, then what does that call me to? If I truly have that gift, what does that call me to do? What am I not doing? And you could say the same thing, I think, in terms of big capital T truths. You know, I think this example is meant to be God or some ultimate being. You know, that is... It's overwhelming. It's greater than we can imagine. And so I think we want to push it away and go back into what's comfortable.
Yeah. And it's so often it's not black or white. It's full of mystery and it's, you know, sort of uneasy. It's not simple and easy to digest, as you said. And we want the truth to be simple and not be confounding or something that makes us feel incapable or foolish or, you know, 100 other negative things. And even as you say, positive things, there's a responsibility tied to learning the truth about something. You have the responsibility to then do something about it. And that's not always comfortable.
No, it's really not. And I think that probably that responsibility is a big part of what the fear is about. Quick segue, Lori. What else did Anthony DeMello write? That is such a familiar name to me.
Well,
anything
let
you
me
know?
See. Anything I know. Not offhand. He is an SJ.
Okay. Maybe that's
so
where
that
I've picked it up. Okay. Well, yeah, don't go doing research, but I thought sometimes you just know. You're so worldly about authors. So.
Oh, yes. Yes, me. Well, here's our next little nugget of truth. When the sparrow builds its nest in the forest, it occupies but a single branch. When the deer slakes its thirst at the river, it drinks no more than its belly can hold. We collect things because our hearts are empty. And would you agree, and why would people think that things will fill an empty heart?
I find this, I like the visuals of the sparrow and the deer. And I think you could make this, you could draw a conclusion or a similar thing about not only us collecting things, but, you know, it's why we eat more than we need when we're not hungry and things like that. I think it's because we have trouble facing the deepest emptiness in ourselves and really being comfortable with it. I mean, it goes back in some ways to the first quotation that we did. You know, when you sit with the truth about yourself or are faced with the truth about yourself and the truth that there is some emptiness inside, and there always is going to be until you, in my worldview, until you come to the time when you are in heaven and with the Lord, It's frightening to leave it empty. It's like you want to do anything to distract yourself from having to face what's in there, what's you, what's the most deep sadness, loneliness, you know, unfulfilled mm-hmm. dreams and things like that. It means we've overcomplicated things too, but go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was thinking of collecting in the very literal sense, in that most people or many people collect things from their childhoods, whether it's, you know, baseball cards or comic books. And mm-hmm. I think what they're not really collecting those things. They're sort of collecting the feelings they had when they enjoyed those things, or the feelings
yes.
of being a kid and being excited about things, or collecting their past in a way, or reclaiming it in a weird way.
Yes.
So, yeah, I think that we see things and we think we want them, and that getting them will do something good for us. But often I really think it's more the wanting of the thing that's fulfilling than the having of it. Does that make sense?
I do, but I think it's both and. I mean, there definitely are times where I don't feel this often, but occasionally I'll feel like, you know, I don't spend much money. I don't really buy clothes or things that much. So sometimes I'll get to feeling resentful, like, well, I haven't bought myself anything in a while, so I'm going to do that mm-hmm. and I'll feel better. And then I do it and I'm like, yeah, well, that was pretty empty.
Yeah.
But the thing where, in terms of just possessions, I agree with you about the feelings, because I have certain things that were my mother's that are things I really don't need. And they're in most cases duplicates of things I have. And I've been trying to work on letting go. But then it's like
yeah.
letting go of my mom.
Mm-hmm.
You know? It's like
a
substitute for something else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think a lot of things are that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, here's our next
question.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to
say, I kind of have
this sense, and I kind of feel this way. It's almost like having a talisman that somehow, if you leave this world, this stuff will keep you in this world, when that's really not possible.
Hmm. Interesting. I wonder if that's why I always get so depressed when I go to estate sales, especially when I see people's pictures. Because it makes me feel terrible inside that this is what's left of their lives, just these things.
Yeah. Yeah, wow. Yeah, I never think
depressing.
I don't go to estate sales. That might be why. Huh.
Well, let's move on to the next quotation. Spirituality is not knowing what you want, but understanding what you do not need. Explain this one to me, because I'm a little foggy on it.
Oh, I kind of like this. It's like when you really begin to dig and get comfortable with that inner space and who you are, you begin to know that the things you have are what you rely on as long as you have them. And so letting go and kind of getting down to that empty space is the goal of our lives on Earth, our life in this space. And so if you really can tune into that, it will say, I can live without all these things. And the more you do it, the less and less and less you can live with. It's just a process of living in some ways, I think, in getting older is really a process of letting go.
That is true.
Does that help?
Yes, that does. And it's very Buddhist of you, I must say.
I'm very, very Buddhist today. I like that definition, though, because I think as you're doing spiritual direction, this would be a really interesting thing to work with. Kind of start with naming the things you believe you need, and then as you work through spiritual direction, kind of reexamine that list over and over again at intervals and see how that changes.
Ooh, that is interesting. I'll have to think about doing that, maybe during Lent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's
well,
actually
anyway.
Be a good Lenten one. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, it would. Well, an ancient legend has it that when God was creating the world, he was approached by four angels. The first one asked, "How are you doing it?" The second, "Why are you doing it?" The third, "Can I be of help?" The fourth, "What is it worth?" The first was a scientist, the second a philosopher, the third an altruist, and the fourth a real estate agent. A fifth angel watched in wonder and applauded in sheer delight. This one was the mystic. In which angel do you find yourself, Alice, and why?
Can I be of help? That's my first one. And how are you doing it is my second one. What about you?
See, I thought you were going to pick those two because those are descriptive of you. I would never, ever, ever call myself a mystic because I don't remotely qualify. But I feel the most kinship with the angel that's watching and marveling because I think I find myself in that position a lot, admiring and enjoying the accomplishments of others. And I think that's why I love reading and I love nature. It's that kind of sense of an endless curiosity and delight in small things. Like, I'm the easiest person in the world to surprise. I never am thinking that someone's going to surprise me in any way.
Yeah.
So the tiniest
thing
is, like, awesome to me.
That's
wonderful.
That's where
I fit in.
That's so funny. Yeah, and as I look at those, I guess I would have had to have picked that for you because I would not. Maybe how are you doing it might be something I could see you asking, but the others, you know, I mean, not that you wouldn't the others, but they're not the first thing I'd think of. Now, what is it worth is the furthest thing that I would ever ask.
Yes, but, that's what I thought too.
But I would like to be in a conversation, Lori, in a group where there were people representing each of these four angels, because I think it'd be interesting to hear their perspective on where they think that's coming from or what that says about them.
Yeah. Yeah, that is good. Okay. Well, if there's anybody out there who thinks that they are represented by one of these angels, hey,
let us know.
Yeah.
Well, how about this insight? Our enemies are not those who hate us, but those whom we hate. How is this true? Or is it?
Well, this makes me tune into something I think I've shared before related to my brother Ted, who always stands as kind of a mirror to me to say, you know, when you're struggling with someone else, you're really typically struggling with something within yourself and it's being projected onto that other person. So what is it that you're struggling with in yourself? I think that speaks to this. I mean, I think it ties into it. And so I think I look at examples even from this week of people who I'm just feeling a little uncomfortable with around at work. And it's mostly me projecting my own feelings of inadequacy or issues I have had with them in the past that were my issues, feeling like they're uncomfortable around me when really it's me uncomfortable around them. Now they're not my enemies, but I don't know if that helps clarify that for you or you even understand me, but that's kind of where I react to it.
Yeah, I get that. I would say that the more corrosive of the two groups is definitely those we hate, because hate eats away at a person and it makes us worse than we are. I'm trying to think of the exact phrase, but somebody said something, and I'm paraphrasing, hating someone is allowing them to live in your head rent-free.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that seems so counterproductive if you hate somebody, and yet I think that's what most of us do.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we hold on to things. And really, when you really get down to it, and I think we've talked about this before, too, most of us, Lori, are so busy thinking about ourselves, even really mature people who we think probably aren't, probably really are, that I'm not sure we're really hating anybody else actively. Yes, we're so focused on ourselves.
You think it's all self-directed?
I mean, I think a lot of it probably is. And I think a lot of it's focused on our own sense of not being treated fairly and squarely. You know, with equity, with regard, whatever. I mean, which ultimately isn't always about ourselves, but I think it is to some degree.
It is, yeah. Okay, good to think about. Well, here's another one. Perfect listening is listening not so much to others as to oneself. Perfect sight is seeing not others so much as oneself. For they fail to understand the other who have not heard themselves. And they are blind to the reality of others who have not probed themselves. The perfect listener hears you even when you say nothing. What do you think about this, Alice? How does a person hear someone when they aren't saying anything?
Sometimes during the show when we read quotations like this, I think, some, sometimes I agree so much with this stuff that I think, am I really reading it critically? You know, do I really agree with it? Do I really agree with it, or do I really disagree with it? Which is a very weird quality about me. I mean, I can say that I can hear what people are saying through body language and just through a feeling I have in being around them. And sometimes you know what people normally say, and when they're not saying it, you can read into that.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I think we know one another to some degree and know how much we have a sense of how much self-awareness the people around us have in some cases. I mean, our closer peeps. And so we know the types of struggles that they have, and if they haven't looked at something deeply, I think we know that by the way they're reacting to it.
Yeah. For some reason, these aphorisms keep popping into my head, but there's another saying that's something about if you really hear somebody, then it changes you in some way.
Yes.
But, yeah, so I would think if you have no sense of yourself, then all you're going to hear is just words. It's not going to mean anything to you unless you're changed in some way, and that requires knowing yourself.
Mm-hmm. I practice more and more, and I keep working at it, trying to just listen and be present and let silence happen after the person stops speaking. Because my inclination is to be a problem solver or be a solution giver.
Sure.
And it's so uncomfortable. Silence is so uncomfortable for me. And a situation where it feels like one of us or both of us don't know what to say is hard. But I'm getting more comfortable with it as I get older, which is a good thing.
Yeah.
But it's difficult.
Yeah, because that's one of the things that you have to start letting go of is fixing everybody's problems and filling every silence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I, again, if I'm trying to do that, Lori, then I'm projecting onto others that they're exactly like I am and that they're as uncomfortable as I am with the silence and, you know, that whole thing. And that's self-centered.
Well said. Well, we're both married people, Alice. What do we think of this saying? It is quite impossible to be happily married to another if one does not first get a divorce from oneself. I hear you laughing.
And isn't that the battle we continually fight through every year of marriage? Oh, I think, you know, you understand the concept of dying to self and in marriage, because you have to, well, you don't have to, but if you are going to be walking in marriage with any kind of peace and feeling like you have truly have a person who is a partner and someone who is an extension of yourself or whatever, I think you have to really die to yourself and some of the things that your ways that certain things have to be done a certain way. You know, that whole set of rules that we have as human beings that we're not even aware we have. I think marriage is an opportunity every day for humility and prayer. And let me give you an example that happened just this morning, and in fact, every morning. My dear one, who is a dear one, gets up in the morning, opens the cabinet where there are coffee cups, takes down a coffee cup, walks away, leaves the cabinet door open. My inclination every morning is to say, John, why can you not close the cabinet door? But in the last probably 6 to 8 months, I'm saying to myself, close the cabinet door and just say a prayer for him. He's not doing it on purpose. He's not doing it to irritate you. He really is not going to correct it. I mean, and I'm not going to nag about it. I'm not going to fall on the sword over an open cabinet. They're just bigger things. But, you know, 21 years ago, oh, that would have been an occasion. I could have divorced the man over that cabinet. So I'm trying to say, you know, he's giving me an opportunity to learn about myself and grow and change myself. So
Yes, that's definitely true that we have those opportunities every day in marriage. And I agree with you. I think we get more and more temperate, mm-hmm. forgiving, open-hearted mm-hmm. as we get older. as you deal with more and more things that come up in married life, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I do think you – go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just saying that there's a little something about the word divorce from oneself that bugs me, just in that I think you have to value yourself in a relationship. I don't think you should mm-hmm. be completely self-effacing and you know, lose yourself in the relationship. I think you have to value what you believe in and what you're worth and be true to those things in a marriage.
Mm-hmm. I do too. And I think it's really about within yourself. You have to make a distinction between what are the essential kind of core foundational things that are non-negotiable, which you do in a divorce proceeding, you know, care of children, household, you know, and what are the things that are really just ephemeral, that are just throwaway, that are just things like the cabinet being open, you know, who cares?
Yes.
You got to choose your battles, I guess.
Yes. Yes. And I think those battles change over time.
Yeah, I do too.
Okay, here's another one. To relate is to react. To react is to understand oneself. To understand oneself is to be enlightened. Relationships are schools for enlightenment. How so, would you say?
I don't think about relating as reacting. I have not really encountered that thought before. I guess that's true. I mean, in some ways, if you're going to have any relation to another people, it's probably like a chemical reaction. There's going to be some synergy there, good, bad, or otherwise. I mean, I think to go back to the previous quotation about marriage, and I could say this about my mother-in-law living with us, I have learned far more. I know a lot of things about my husband. I know a lot of things about my friends, my siblings. But as I grow in those relationships, what I come to know more and more is more about myself. Because that, you know, you can see, have them not be a mirror, but, you know, just a separate person from yourself that you can see the differences and then say, oh, I didn't even realize this about myself. And the difference between me and Lori helps me understand who I am a little bit better, because
exactly.
I can see a comparison. Mm-hmm.
Yes, yes. And as you were saying about chemicals, it's, to me, that's exactly it. You define yourself, you define who you are either with the other person or against the other person. I am like Alice in that. I am unlike Alice in that. So it ends up that you're going to understand yourself a little bit better. And I also think it stretches you to respond in ways that are less comfortable or selfish. I mean, if we didn't have relationships, I could do everything my own way without worrying about how anybody else wanted it. If I didn't feel like talking to anybody, I wouldn't have to talk to them. But because I want to be in relationship, I stretch myself to do things that I wouldn't ordinarily demand of myself.
And I guess the thing that comes naturally out of that whole thing for me is, is there a core Lori that is present when not held against the other relationships? You know, I think that's kind of the search and the challenge in all this, because I agree with you. I want to be a relational person. I think we were meant to be in relationship, but who am I outside of those relationships? And I guess the answer, in some ways, oversimplifying, is I am always in relationship with God, so therefore I'm always able to use that as a relational test, if you will.
Yeah, yeah, that's good. Okay, here's another story. Once upon a time, God gave a party for all the virtues, great and small, humble and heroic. They all gathered together in a splendidly decorated hall in heaven, and soon began to enjoy themselves because they were well acquainted with one another. Some were even closely related. Suddenly, God spotted two fair virtues who seemed not to know each other at all and were somewhat ill at ease in each other's company. So he took one of them by the hand and formally introduced her to the other. "Gratitude," he said, "this is charity." But God had hardly turned around when they were again parted. And so the story has gone around that even God cannot bring gratitude to where charity is.
Hmm.
What are your thoughts on this story?
My thoughts on this story are that I think it's very, very, it's like humility. Charity is a very, if you look at charity as giving to others, let's mm-hmm. just in a broad sense, it is, and receiving from others, I guess, receiving charity is difficult to be thankful for because it's, there's so much humility and or lack of humility in that. You know, it's difficult for us to feel needy. It's difficult for us to accept help. And so, therefore, it's difficult to be thankful for it.
Yeah, yeah. And in any case, you can't force an emotion from another person, even gratitude.
Mm-mm.
I mean, I can't
Mm-mm.
make you feel something without your permission.
That is correct. Well, and I for some reason, this is taking me down the path of thinking about the true motivations for why I and we do things in life. And, you know, are we in touch with the times when we're doing something, some act of charity, because we want and expect gratitude, and then we're disappointed when we don't get it? You know, you think of people talking about delivering Thanksgiving meals and how difficult it can be because of how the reactions can be. That scenario comes to my mind here.
Yeah, yeah. It comes back to why are you doing it to begin with?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I know that's an issue for me because a friend once said to me, you know, if you're not doing things with a joyful, grateful heart, you know, and if you're begrudging about the volunteer service you're doing, you better reconsider it and stop it because that's, you know, a joyful giver is what God is really looking for. And I have really used that as a litmus test at times. When I find myself complaining about volunteer services I'm doing or whatever, it's like, you know, I need to be joyful about this or stop doing it because I'm not doing it for the right reasons if I'm getting that much ego issue stuff out of it, you know, or not getting
yeah.
it out of it, as the case may be.
Yeah. Oh, that's a good thing to think about. Well, I'm just going to read this last one, and we're going to leave it in the air for people to listen to. The spiritual quest is a journey without distance. You travel from where you are right now to where you have always been, from ignorance to recognition, for all you do is see for the first time what you have always been looking at. Whoever heard of a path that brings you to yourself or a method that makes you what you have always been? Spirituality, after all, is only a matter of becoming what you really are. And that is our time for this week. So we're going to take a couple of weeks off for the holidays, but we will be back in December, never fear. Until then, if you're looking for God, just open a book.
Have a great week.